From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Rhode Island Congressman David Cicilline gives us a firsthand account of what's happening at ICE detention centers in Texas.
What is being done at the border to these children and ripping them from their parents is a national disgrace.
Also today, are your kids juuling? We'll look at the effects of the super popular e-cigarette.
Any kid who is using this product has the product illegally. So it's already regulated. It's illegal for a kid to have the product. Kids shouldn't get it. They shouldn't be able to go with fake IDs. They shouldn't be able to get it with people who don't check IDs.
And our series on 25 years of ed reform in Massachusetts continues with a look at MCAS. Has it helped educational outcomes or held some kids back?
When I think about it empathetically, I say, oh my gosh, if I had to take a standardized test in a language that I didn't know, I would be anxious and worried and scared.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. President Donald Trump continues to defend his controversial policy of separating migrant parents and children at the U.S. border. Speaking to the National Federation of Independent Businesses in Washington today, Trump made a series of claims about immigration policy that are not supported by fact.
Under current law, we have only two policy options to respond to this massive crisis. We can either release all illegal immigrant families and minors who show up at the border from Central America, or we can arrest the adults for the federal crime of illegal entry. Those are the only two options: totally open borders or criminal prosecution for lawbreaking.
There are, in fact, other options available to the Trump administration, such as detaining families together for certain periods of time, as was done before April when his administration instituted a zero-tolerance policy on border-crossing offenses. Rhode Island Congressman David Cicilline recently visited a number of those detention facilities, those ICE detention and processing facilities in Texas, where children are being held, and he joins us now. Congressman Cicilline, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So you went to a number of facilities on the United States southern border. I wonder if you could actually just tell us specifically, to begin with, about the Port Isabel ICE detention facility. What did you see there?
So at the Port Isabel detention facility, we met with 10 moms who were in detention, who had their children taken from them. All of them were claiming asylum, so they were fleeing really incredible violence, gang violence, domestic abuse. You know, they came to the United States seeking asylum, and when they arrived in the U.S., they were taken into custody, and their children were separated from them.
Can I just jump in here for a second? I'm so
sure.
Sorry. Did they tell you how the children were separated from them, what the ICE or whomever, what the agents told them when they took the children away?
The women that we met with explained that the children were just taken away. Nobody explained to them where they were going, why they were being taken away. Many of the women today did not know where their children were. A couple of them had had phone contact with their children, but they didn't share any information with these moms. They just removed their children, and without any explanation.
DHS is saying, though, that it's giving a kind of handout or a flyer to parents that has phone numbers that they can call, so that the DHS is claiming that parents shouldn't have any trouble trying to find where their kids are.
Well, that's not the experiences we heard. In fact, we met with a woman who made several inquiries in the facility that she's being held about where her daughter is and got no information.
So I want to play a little bit of tape from a Facebook Live video that you posted after you left the Port Isabel ICE detention facility, because I think it sort of highlights the questions that so many people have around how the administration's or what the administration's actual policies are in terms of, the American people and their representatives trying to find out what's going on in these facilities. So you were trying to shoot a quick video in the parking lot outside of the detention facility. And here's what happened. There's a lot of wind noise in this. I just want to let listeners know, so that you might have to pay close attention, but I just want to play it anyway. Here goes.
Really heartbreaking stories and separated from their kids.
We don't allow any recording devices here in the facility.
We're not recording. It's a Facebook Live.
It's still the same thing. And then electronic devices with the facility here, we don't allow it.
We can't broadcast what we just saw?
I'll speak a little better.
We can't report to our constituents what we just saw in a federal detention facility.
No, well, you're okay when you're coming. We're not allowed. It's not allowed.
In the parking lot?
In the parking lot. Yes, sir.
Not allowed pursuant to. It's ICE.
It's an ICE thing.
So, Congressman Cicilline, that's an ICE agent coming up to you in the parking lot saying that you can't record even a Facebook live stream in the parking lot. And then you ask him why, pursuant to what regulation, and all he tells you was, it's an ICE thing?
Right. I mean, we had just left the facility, and I think, you know, part of the reason we're making these visits is not only to learn about what's happening, but to raise the awareness of the American people, what's being done in their name. So I tried after that visit to kind of report on what I had just seen, the mothers I had just met with. And, of course, I waited till we're outside the facility because you're not allowed to take your phone into the facility, which I understood. So we're out in the parking lot with the facility in the background, and he said there's no recording on, you know, even in the parking lot. I don't know whether that's really a regulation or not, but the notion that we don't have the ability to share, you know, immediately after leaving the facility, our observations with our constituents who have raised serious concerns about it was very disappointing to me. And, you know, we had to find other ways to get this information out.
So let me ask you about the children's shelter that you visited in Brownsville. What did you see there? Because you were able to go inside there as well.
Well, I mean, in that facility, it's called Casa Padre, which was, you know, the cruel irony is that we were there on Father's Day. But there are 1,500 kids in that facility. It was originally designed for 300 kids, so it's really overcrowded. There are 4 kids to a room. I think the agency that's doing the work does the best they can. They have been in this field for 30 years providing services to children in detention. But, you know, it's a detention facility. I mean, these young people are in custody, having done nothing wrong. And, you know, it's unclear kind of how long they'll stay there. And they make efforts to reunify these kids with family members or appropriate placements. But it's a very crowded, very difficult situation for the young people.
I mean, I take your point that this is an agency that's been doing this work for several decades, but did they tell you that they're able to meet the needs of 1,500 kids in a facility designed for 300?
No. I mean, they made it clear they need mental health professionals that they're, you know, that they need to hire. I think the figure they used was about 95 additional mental health professionals. But, you know, there's no way that you can provide, you know, in our country, the standard is supposed to be what's in the best interest of a child. And if they're in placement, it's supposed to be a last resort, and you're supposed to make it as much like home as possible. That can't be done successfully with this many children in that space.
Now, you also visited a Border Patrol processing center and a Border Patrol station in McAllen, Texas, and a port of entry in Hidalgo. The most important things you saw in those places?
Well, the most important things we saw and learned was that for the port of entry, that we talked to a human rights, civil rights lawyer who has been very involved in the situation there, and she recounted for us the fact that people were coming to the port of entry to seek asylum and sometimes were waiting days, sometimes as long as 2 weeks on the bridge, that they weren't being allowed into the waiting area, which is air-conditioned. So this is over 100-degree heat, no bathrooms, no food, no water, just waiting to come in. And they can't return and leave the bridge because the criminal gangs are right in that area, that they will then subject themselves to violence or being kidnapped and their family being asked to pay ransom. So there are real problems, but they're left in the sort of in the middle there where they can't come into the facility and begin to be processed for asylum, and they yet can't go back because of the dangers. So it's a very, very unacceptable situation. And, you know, they had a very few number of people who were actually in claiming asylum because the conditions have been made so unpleasant that lots of people are trying to figure out other ways to come to the U.S. and claim asylum. When we went to the processing center, we saw people that were literally in these pens that are like cages. They refer to it as the dog pound. Because
who's the they? Who calls it the dog pound?
The residents there, the people who are being held.
I see. Okay.
Because it describes these big, you know, cages that people were in. And there was, you know, very young children that are in there awaiting processing. I mean, it is, you know, there's nothing in these big fenced-in areas. There's a few mats for some of them and these kind of plastic silver blankets. But, you know, they're overcrowded. Folks are sitting on the floor awaiting processing, and it's a terrible, terrible situation.
You know, 10 members of Congress, Democrats, are calling for Homeland Security Secretary Nielsen to resign. Do you think she should resign?
Absolutely. Look, Secretary Nielsen has independent responsibilities as the director of the Department of Homeland Security to make judgments about the resources her department has and how they should most effectively put to use, and to make a priority of prosecuting and detaining parents who are bringing children across the border fleeing unspeakable violence, who are entitled under our law to asylum, to say that's a priority, to criminally prosecute those women in an effort to extinguish their ability to claim asylum, and while doing so to separate their children from them, is a gross error of judgment. It undermines the rule of law in this country, our founding values, and she ought not to have the privilege of leading the Department of Homeland Security in light of her decision to do that. And the notion that, well, this is the urging of the Attorney General, she doesn't work for the Attorney General, she works for the American people. She has independent responsibilities, and I think her implementation of this zero-tolerance policy makes her disqualifies her from continuing to lead that department.
Mm. I mean, to be frank, though, to the point you were just making, say, hypothetically, Secretary Nielsen were to resign, it would be rather symbolic and possibly have a big impact, but nevertheless, it doesn't change the posture or intent of Attorney General Sessions, of White House Advisor Stephen Miller, or the President of the United States at all. I mean, what difference would it make?
Well, I mean, hopefully she would be replaced by a secretary who would exercise independent judgment and not implement this policy. But look, the only way this is going to change is if people continue to speak out and demand that the administration stop this policy immediately. You know, President Lincoln said, you know, public sentiment is everything. This is a policy that was put into place by this administration. It can be stopped today with a phone call from the president to his relevant department heads. This is not a partisan issue. This is about what our values are as a country and the kind of moral leadership we provide to the world. And what is being done at the border to these children and ripping them from their parents is a national disgrace, and it needs to end.
Two more quick things, if I may. You're right in pointing out that this is a policy implemented by the Trump administration. But as you well know, the administration itself in the past several days has been pointing the finger back at Congress. I mean, here's Secretary Nielsen again at the White House yesterday saying she thinks Congress is the one that needs to solve this problem.
Until these loopholes are closed by Congress, it is not possible as a matter of law to detain and remove whole family units who arrive illegally in the United States. Congress and the courts created this problem, and Congress alone can fix it.
Now, to fact check this, it is a Trump administration policy that has led to the separation of parents and children at the border. But I just wanted to get your response to what Secretary Nielsen is saying.
It's completely misleading. It is, in fact, congressional action is not required to stop this. There is no requirement in the law that this happened, which is why it didn't happen until 6 weeks ago when the president developed this zero-tolerance policy. So there's nothing in the law that requires the separation of children from their parents, number one. So they could stop it instantaneously. She could stop it even without a call from the president. Could Congress explicitly prohibit it? Yes. And if our Republican colleagues will work with us, we will do that. But there is no requirement that this happen. And she has made this judgment to prosecute every single person who comes across the border, no matter how they get here, even if they're making legitimate claims of asylum, to criminally prosecute them and separate their children from them in an effort to basically extinguish your right to petition for asylum. I mean, if you come across the border, whether you come at a point of entry or you come another way, and you go to a Border Patrol officer and you say, I want to claim asylum, if the policy of the United States is we're going to criminally charge you for coming across the border to make that claim, you have effectively ended asylum. It's monstrous. And she could stop it today. The president could stop it today. We are going to push hard for legislation to compel them to do that. But we obviously have to get some support from our Republican colleagues to do it.
You know, the president of the United States has called Democrats the obstructionists here, saying that Democrats are not willing to even, these are his words, Donald Trump's words, to come to the table to negotiate on Republican suggested immigration bills. And that if they did, this problem would be solved. I mean, we have some pending bills here. What's your thought?
This is the most pernicious and despicable thing the president said. He's trying to use the ripping away of children from their mothers as a bargaining chip to try to negotiate an immigration bill. We have worked in good faith. There have been a number of bipartisan bills that would fix our broken immigration system. The president is trying to move forward in some come in a really sinister way at the expense of these children and try to negotiate the building of his wall. It's despicable. It's wrong. Democrats have always been willing to work in a bipartisan way on immigration. We almost had a bill forced to the floor over the objection of the Speaker last week. We were short two votes. It had the support of every single Democrat and about 22 Republicans. So we have solutions to this, but the president instead is pandering to his base with this really, really despicable policy that the American people, I think, the more they learn about it, are not going to permit it to continue.
Well, Rhode Island Congressman David Cicilline, thank you so very much.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Back in 1 minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's talk about e-cigarettes, particularly about the ones sold by Juul Labs. Maybe you've seen them or tried them yourself. Maybe if you're a parent, you've heard about Juuling through your kids, because it seems as if these sleek little devices are everywhere now. I mean, just consider this. Just last week, Attorney General Maura Healey sent a letter to Massachusetts school districts saying, quote, over the last few years, e-cigarette use has increased 900% among high school students in the United States. The AG went on to write, quote, Juul Labs has contacted Massachusetts schools to promote their prevention education program and offer schools a monetary incentive to pilot this program. The Attorney General said, we urge you to explore alternative options. Now, we at Radio Boston contacted Juul about this, and they responded with a statement saying, quote, earlier this year, we reached out to schools in an effort to help combat underage use. However, we no longer reach out to schools proactively, end quote. Juul added, though, that in April, the company announced a $30 million three-year effort to combat teenage use of their product. So clearly, there is something to talk about here, because a lot of young people are Juuling. On the one hand, it's 60% of the e-cigarette market. It's huge and it's growing. So let's have a frank conversation about this, about its pros and its cons. And to do so, we're joined by Jonathan Winnikoff. He is a pediatrician at Massachusetts General Hospital. He's a professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. And he's the former chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics Tobacco Consortium. Dr. Winnikoff, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
Also with us is Mike Siegel. He's a physician, researcher, and professor at the Boston University School of Public Health. He's a professor of community health sciences, and he writes the blog Tobacco Analysis. We've got a link to that and other information about e-cigarettes at radioboston.org. Mike Siegel, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me as well.
So, Jonathan Winnikoff, let me just first of all start with you. For people who don't know what Juuling is, I mean, it's an e-cigarette type device. What makes it so seemingly so attractive to people?
So while the marketing of Juul and the flavors that it comes in are attractive to kids, and these are like fruit medley, mango,
mint, cucumber,
mint, cool cucumber. That's the health version, right? It's actually the chemical engineering that they've put into the product itself that has led to now a 65% actually market share for this product in the U.S. The chemical engineering is essentially what they've done is add nicotine salts, add ammonia to the product. They've two and a half fold increased the nicotine content, and they've put a proton group onto the nicotine itself, enabling kids and others to inhale the aerosols more deeply, the ultrafine particles more deeply into the lung. And that provides a nicotine surge through the bloodstream that goes right through the blood-brain barrier and directly into the pleasure centers of the brain.
So are you saying it's more addictive than cigarettes?
It actually, there seems to be more nicotine in the bloodstream getting into the brain than actual combusted cigarettes, yes.
But does that mean it's more addictive?
Probably, yes. But it's a relatively new product. We don't know whether or not it's more addictive than traditional cigarettes or not. But what we do know is they captured the entire U.S. market within the past 18 months.
Mm. Mike Siegel, given what Jonathan Winikoff just said about the, it seems like, the, especially the nicotine content of a little Juul device, are you concerned about its potential public health implications, or do you see something possibly positive with this kind of e-cigarette?
Well, this is, I think, really a classic example of a double-edged sword, because the thing that makes Juul such a tremendous risk for youth is precisely the thing that makes it effective for adult smokers who are trying to quit. So I think it's important that we keep in mind that the whole purpose of electronic cigarettes in the first place was not to try to addict kids, but the purpose of these products originally was to help adult smokers quit. The rates of quitting for adult smokers who want to quit are very, very low. Only about 10% of smokers who try the currently available therapies like the nicotine patch are successful. So the question is, what do we do for that other 90%? And it turns out that for that other 90%, for many of them, e-cigarettes are lifesavers. They are a way of quitting smoking without having to actually give up the nicotine and give up some of the behavioral and physical stimuli that come along with it. So the problem with most e-cigarettes is that they don't deliver nicotine in an effective way. And so many smokers who are trying these products, they give up. They don't, yeah. They're not satisfying enough.
Well, so let me just jump in here. And the nub of this issue, I'm mixing my metaphors here, so forgive me, the heart of the matter is kind of along the lines of what you just said, that some people see these e-cigarettes as being a way to avoid the consequences of terrible lung cancer, for example, in adult smokers. But on the other hand, we're already seeing masses of young people who technically aren't even old enough to buy e-cigarettes having tried them. I mean, the Attorney General in her letter to districts said that in 2015, this is just when Juul itself first came online, 50% of Massachusetts high schoolers had said they'd tried an e-cigarette. And Jonathan Winikoff is saying it's potentially far more addictive. So it seems like double-edged sword is a light way of putting it, Mike Siegel. And Jonathan, I'll come back to you in a second, but your response to that?
Well, I think the question really is what we do about it. I mean, I don't think there's any question that electronic cigarettes are a health benefit for smokers who switch to them. And I don't think there's any doubt that electronic cigarettes, but particularly the Juul, is a tremendous health risk, and particularly a risk of addiction for youth who try it. So the question is, what do we do about it? And I think the art of public health is basically figuring out how can we maximize the benefits of electronic cigarettes for adult smokers, but at the same time, try to minimize the risks for youth. And I think we can do it. I don't think that these are mutually exclusive things. I don't think the road has to be either all of our kids are getting addicted or all of the, you know, adult smokers are quitting. Okay. I think there's a middle ground.
Jonathan Winikoff, do you have a response to that?
Well, I just need your listeners to understand that there's no definitive evidence that e-cigarettes do any better than the currently existing FDA-approved nicotine replacement medications when used in combination. And we're talking about nicotine patch plus nicotine gum. And there's a lot of concern, including by our own CDC, that the types of messages that we're hearing from the e-cigarette industry, that these are lifesavers, is actually the industry trying to market their product ahead of where the science is. And if that's the story that gets out and we end up not helping patients with FDA-approved nicotine replacement medicines, and instead we listen to the corporations who have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders, the public health may suffer.
But point taken. But as Mike Siegel was just saying, he doesn't see this as an either or, that it's either, you know, make these products available to aid adults or, you know, pit them against teenagers who want to try them and may become addicted, that we can find a public health. That's what he was saying. We can find a public health solution.
Yeah, except that if there's already something out there that's safer and healthier to use to get off traditional cigarettes, and if that's actually been if it's actually been working in terms of lowering the tobacco use rate, then why would we be introducing something that could addict, the next generation of our nation's children to tobacco products.
Mike Siegel, it does seem to me to be curious, to say the least, that Juul, roughly 3 years after its, you know, introduction in the mass market, is already having to say that we are spending $30 million to combat teenage use of our product. So the problem already exists, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the problem really occurred overnight. The Juul became popular. I mean, if you go to the last school year, we really weren't seeing much use of Juul at all. And it was this school year, starting in the fall, that it just kind of took off and essentially went viral, if you can use that analogy.
Now, is that because of something Juul itself is doing in marketing its product, or soft marketing it through social media, that kind of thing?
I really don't think so. There was no discernible change in their marketing. I think this really happened a lot through social media. What happened is that some kids posted videos blowing smoke. Well, they're not smoke rings. They're really aerosol rings or vapor rings with the Juul device. And all of a sudden, that became a kind of a meme and took off virally among youth. You know, there are, sometimes you just can't predict what makes things kind of go with youth. And, you know, at one point it was fidget spinners, and they went wild, and everybody seemed to be using them. And now that I finally decided to buy one, you know, now I find out that I'm 2 years behind the time. They kind of came and went.
With all due respect, Professor Siegel, fidget spinners and nicotine delivery systems that cross the blood-brain barrier much, much faster than a regular cigarette aren't really comparable things.
No. I mean, obviously they're not comparable. I'm just using it as an example to show how there are products that just become very popular among youth and that we can't really explain their popularity. There was no big push by the fidget spinner companies, you know, that suddenly they started marketing this. You know, sometimes things happen and youth just get into things and that can spread.
Yeah.
To your point, though, Magna, about the blood-brain barrier, I mean, I think that it's the chemical engineering of the nicotine itself that accounts for this rapid rise. They actually chemically engineered the product to be more highly addictive, and that's how you gain market share. That's what the tobacco industry learned, and that's what Juul learned by partnering with Big Tobacco.
But let me ask you, Dr. Winikoff, I mean, we have... Are we at a risk of overreacting to something that could well be a fad? Because we already have in place regulations around tobacco products. We'll have, once it gets fully implemented, regulations around marijuana. There's regulations around alcohol. All of these things, these chemicals that people can choose to ingest, we have crafted regulations around them and policies and programs to help be sure that they don't have an unhealthy impact on young people. Why can't we do that with Juul?
I mean, if this were just a fad, then I wouldn't be concerned. But what I'm seeing in my office on a daily basis is every single high schooler comes in and they either know kids who are actively addicted to Juul or they are addicted themselves. Let me just give you a story. I've had two kids come in and tell me that they sleep with their Juul in bed because they can't even make it to morning without taking hits. Now, this is not a fad. This is something that is changing their brains and maybe permanently making them hungry for nicotine. And one of the other things that Juul won't tell you is that the current data show that if you are nicotine addicted and you're using an electronic cigarette, you are much more likely to go on to regular tobacco use. And that data is between 4- and 10-fold increased risk of going on to regular combusted tobacco.
We've got just a minute to go, Mike Siegel, and we could talk about this for hours because I find it to be an incredibly important and interesting topic, but I'm afraid we just got a little bit of time left here. I take your point earlier about sort of the big picture public health issues that we have to think about, but for parents who are listening right now, I mean, what would you suggest to them if they do have concerns about Juul?
Well, I think that parents need to do everything that they can to keep their kids from using the Juul. And I think that part of that is education. I think that kids need to really understand that this is addictive. It's not like pretty much every other electronic cigarette that's out there. I think that there's a qualitative difference between Juul and literally every other product on the market. And kids need to understand that this is a particularly dangerous drug because it's particularly addictive because, as Dr. Winnikoff explained, the nicotine delivery to the brain is very similar as it is with a cigarette.
Right.
So I think kids need to understand that, and somehow we have to help them to kind of put the Juul in a completely different category.
Yeah. Jonathan Winnikoff, last question to you. I mean, you can feel free to comment on what parents should do, but I just wonder, how far would you go in regulating these? It sounds to me like you want them, what, to be banned?
Yeah, well, I think they need to be completely out of the realm of being able to purchase in a convenience store, and that's where the majority of kids get this. We need strict regulations. We need to make sure that kids just do not have access to this product. Otherwise, we're facing a really epidemic situation. We already are in Massachusetts with over 25% of high school seniors graduating as current Juul users.
Really? Where did that data come from?
YRBSS.
Which is?
The Youth Behavior Risk Surveillance Survey in Massachusetts. And that's one reason why Maura Healey is really concerned.
Well, Jonathan Winnikoff, he's a pediatrician at MGH and a professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. Thank you so much. And Mike Siegel, professor of community health sciences at the Boston University School of Public Health and author of the Tobacco Analysis blog. Thank you as well.
My pleasure.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This week, WBUR is examining the consequences of the landmark 1993 law that changed K-12 education in Massachusetts. Our Edify team is bringing you a series called Pass-Fail, Evaluating 25 Years of Education Reform. And today, we're going to take a look at the MCAS, the statewide standardized test that's been both credited with helping make Massachusetts schools some of the best in the nation, and perhaps exacerbating the very achievement gaps it was meant to help close. Reporters Carrie Young and Max Larkin look at one group of Massachusetts students who are struggling.
Over the years, immigrants arrived to begin new lives in America. To them, the Statue of Liberty is a symbol of all their hopes and dreams.
So, Carrie, I was in this classroom in Revere a few weeks ago. The kids were doing a unit on the Statue of Liberty.
Your parents came from a different country, right? Yeah. Did they come on a ship or did they come on an airplane?
Airplane, but my mother came the first one, and like after 6 months we came to America.
When I was growing up, Revere was kind of an Irish-Italian enclave, a little beach town north of Boston.
Yeah, but I was looking at the census data, and there has been a huge influx of immigrants there in the last few years at least.
Like these two young students we're about to hear from, Joshua Mendez and Anthony Ramos.
English isn't my first language, so.
It's not your first language?
No,
Spanish was my first language.
Portuguese was my first language.
Joshua was born in Brazil. Anthony was also born elsewhere. And they're both now third graders and best friends at the Garfield Elementary School in Revere. When I visited, they had just taken the English language MCAS test for the first time.
It felt nervous the first time.
Yeah, because like I didn't understand some words at the beginning. I guess
you get
it was
more
easier.
Worried because
it's like a
really
big test.
Yeah.
It's a big test.
I get scared.
Joshua and Anthony have been in the country for several years now, Carrie, and it's worth noting they have classmates arriving from overseas every week.
So once a student's been in the country for a year, he or she is supposed to take the MCAS, right?
Exactly right. And their teacher, Penny Caliavis, sees a lot of kids like that, and she says she feels for those students.
When I think about it empathetically, I say, oh my gosh, if I had to take a standardized test in a language that I didn't know, I would be anxious and worried and scared.
So Caliavis says she sees her job as kind of stress management in part. She has little lines that she tells this global classroom of kids.
In the long run, it doesn't make up who they are. It doesn't make up their success. It's just kind of like a measurement.
That kind of measurement, though, was a huge part of the 1993 education reform bill, to have statewide academic standards and then measure how students keep up with them. Here's former state senator Tom Birmingham, who co-authored the bill.
Unless we test, we don't have any way to determine
whether we're succeeding or failing in our education.
But in important ways, the MCAS isn't just a measurement. Low scores were supposed to allow state officials to target schools with changes.
At first, many in the state's Latino community saw the promise of that approach to education reform. Here's Miren Uriarte, a sociologist. She had already been studying Latino students in Massachusetts when the 1993 bill came around, and that's why she was on board.
Because it couldn't get any worse. The dropout rates were through the roof.
The reform bill pumped a lot of money into the state's poorest districts, and Uriarte says as a researcher, she kind of liked having solid numbers.
But here's where she says the reform lost its way. When the first MCAS scores came back, Latino students had posted what she called really dismal numbers. Now, it'd be one thing if policymakers had then targeted their schools with effective changes that could help them improve. But that's not what happened.
In 2002, Massachusetts voters passed an initiative that forced all students to learn in English only. That's called Sheltered English Immersion.
It was sold on very shaky scientific grounds.
Not only did that bill not close the gap, in fact, it's now regarded as kind of a major policy blunder. The legislature finally got rid of the immersion requirement last year.
Then the state legislature, still trying to close that gap, sets up a system in 2010 that puts the poorest performing schools at risk of being taken over by the state.
Even today, the state is running three entire school districts, Lawrence, Holyoke, and Southbridge, with a mixed record to show for it. All of them are majority Latino. Again, Miren Uriarte.
That has always been my complaint. You know, I'm all for accountability, but let's all be accountable, not just the kids.
That's where we are today. So is there anything that's working for English learners? Well, in Revere, educators have managed to keep up their MCAS scores, despite their rapidly changing demographics.
And they'd argue, Carrie, it's because they're focusing on everything but test prep.
It's hot.
For example, at the Garfield Elementary, that's the school we were talking about earlier, they've added emotional supports and another ESL teacher. They even have this thing called a Newcomers Academy, where immigrant students of all ages can play games and speak and learn in more than one language. When I was there, the teacher and principal were modeling clothes so kids could learn the English names for them.
What is it?
Hat!
All right, good. What about this?
Scarf.
Scarf or a sweater?
So that seems to be working in Revere, but it remains to be seen if it can work in other districts, too.
And it raises a question about how to solve problems in education. Is it okay to kind of bumble along and by trial and error eventually find things that work?
That's WBUR's Max Larkin and Carrie Young taking a look at MCAS and English language learners in particular. Now, you know, here at Radio Boston, we like numbers, so let's dig into the numbers for a second, because there is a great data visualization at WBUR.org, and if you go there, you will find, for example, that when it comes to statewide student scores on the 10th grade English MCAS, about 40% of English language learners score needs improvement or worse. 22% of Latino students are also still struggling, 16% of African American students, 19% of economically disadvantaged kids, 32% of students with disabilities. Compare that to the roughly 5% of white and Asian students who need improvement or are failing on the 10th grade English MCAS. So according to its supporters, MCAS is the tool that allows us to measure that achievement gap and then aim for better outcomes. But according to its detractors, the test itself may be contributing to that gap. So does it help or does it hurt? Joining us now to discuss is Ricardo Rosa. He's an assistant professor of educational leadership and policy at UMass Dartmouth. He's also author, co-author, I should say, of Capitalism's Educational Catastrophe. Professor Rosa, welcome to Radio Boston.
Very glad to be here. Thank you.
Also with us is Carrie Rodriguez. She's the founder of Massachusetts Parents United, a parent advocacy organization. They include amongst their donors the Walton Family Foundation, the Barr Foundation, and the National Philanthropic Trust. Carrie Rodriguez has been very active in educational issues in Massachusetts for several years. Welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ricardo Rosa, let me just start with you. And if you don't mind, I'd just like to use your own family as an example here. You've had your kids opt out of MCAS.
That's correct.
Why?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, the test is, you know, any form of high-stakes test amounts to a form of educational malpractice, in my opinion. And it has nothing to do with accountability. It has a whole lot to do with a whole lot of profit making. off of public education. It's a $500 billion business, and folks want to cash in. You have major businesses that want to cash in on this thing. I think that, you know, it's problematic in the sense that, you know, whenever any quantitative social indicator is used to make social, to make to use as a decision-making tool, what happens is that it's very often subject to corruption. And that's precisely what goes on in public schools today. I mean, you have children who score very low who are not being tended to. You have children who score very high who are not being tended to. And most of the focus is on so-called sort of bubble kids, you know, those kids that are just at the margins. And that's problematic for me. That's not education.
Okay. So, Carrie Rodriguez, would you like to respond to that?
Yeah, I don't understand how we're supposed to identify inequity unless we have data points to back it up. For generations, you know, people in our communities have known that our schools have been underperforming and underserving our communities. So until we have actually had data points to back up that argument, we were reduced to anecdote and saying, oh, don't worry about it. Your school is great. Everything's happy in there. Look at all the sunshines on the walls. Unfortunately, when our kids are actually leaving those schools, they're not adequately prepared to go into the workforce or to, you know, go to higher education. They're not ready to go. So unless we have data points, we cannot make improvements. So it just seems kind of crazy that we would say, okay, we're identifying that there are problem schools so that we can actually go after and target these situations, and just saying we're going to throw out the test because we don't like the results we're getting.
So I want to try and bounce back and forth between the two of you as much as possible in the time that we have. So forgive me. I don't mean to interrupt a lot, but forgive me if in advance if I do. But Carrie Rodriguez, I mean, I think one of the first pieces of pushback that folks might give to what you're saying is there's a lot of people out there who believe that maybe the data itself is not entirely reliable because the test itself isn't actually measuring what kids are learning or how much they know. There may be some cultural biases in the test itself. So we're making judgments on educational outcomes on data that may not be reliable.
And I certainly would not say that the MCAS is perfect. I think we have a lot of work to do on it. I think just like we need to work on the diversity in terms of the educational leadership we see in schools themselves, from the classroom management to the administration, we also need to take a look at our diversity in terms of our testing systems and whether or not they're adequately reaching, and are culturally competent and reaching these communities they need to reach. So I'm not going to say that I'm going to defend the MCAS as being the perfect tool by which to measure. But we do need a tool to measure.
Assessment of some kind.
Absolutely.
Okay, so Ricardo Rosa, let me turn back to you, because this, again, it's at the heart of what MCAS's greatest supporters have constantly said, that, you know, 25 years ago, there were huge gaps in outcomes in students. There are persistent gaps now, but that without knowing what those gaps are, how can we make steps forward in improving the quality of the education kids are receiving?
But we know, first of all, I'm not a big fan of this term achievement gap, you know, because as you said, you know, these tests are highly problematic. So in the end, what are youth actually achieving on? And furthermore, it also paints this picture that white affluent kids are standing still, you know, while others are catching up to them. They're constantly moving as well. So I don't like achievement gap. I prefer the use of the term opportunity gap. And also, I mean, we've always known, you know, who's succeeding and who's not succeeding in public schools. We don't need tests to measure them, to measure that. If you look at the tests, I mean, it's highly, it correlates to socioeconomic, to income, you know, to poverty. The issue is poverty. The issue is not you know, needing more data, you know, to prove or to show who's failing and who's not doing well in school so that we can better serve them. The issue is poverty. So we need to look at that. We need to take that very seriously. We need to realize that public and social policy is educational policy. Families that don't have a living, don't have a, you know, adequate wage, don't have adequate benefits, can't find decent public transportation to get to work, are families who are going to have kids who are likely not to have strong educational outcomes.
Carrie, did you want to respond?
I don't disagree with him at all. I think we definitely need to address all of these situations as a whole. Our organization deals with poverty issues, deals with our number one issue that we talk about is building safer neighborhoods. If we can't have any assurance that our kids can walk down the street with, you know, being able to be safe and to be healthy and to use our parks and to not be influenced by gangs or gun violence. I mean, that's number one. Poverty issues, dealing with, do we have a safe home to live in, affordable housing, all of these things. Mm-hmm. But just because we are economically disadvantaged, it does not mean that our children are not capable of achievement. And I think the real problem is the belief gap that we have in Massachusetts, the belief that, you know, because children are of color, because children grow up in economic disadvantaged situations, that they're not capable of achievement and proficiency. And it's horrifying to me as a parent when I hear some of our educators start to talk about, well, some of our kids, you know, they're just capable of growth. And if we're seeing growth in our schools, that's enough. It's not enough. Mm. My children are capable of being proficient. Just because they're Latino, it does not mean that they're not capable of being proficient.
And so how is MCAS helping get to that proficiency, though?
I think being able to assess where we have problems in our school system, where we are not serving our children well, where they are not getting access to high-quality education, we need to know where those problem points are so we can target them, so we can add additional funding, so we can address those issues. Because there are some schools in Massachusetts that are getting this done, that are capable of it. We need to take those ideas and implement them where they're needed.
So, Ricardo Rosa, a little earlier today, we spoke in preparing for this conversation, we spoke with Bob Lee, who's the chief MCAS analyst with the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education. And he said, told us a couple of things. One, that DESE has a bias and sensitivity committee whose job it is to review the test and items to make sure that it's not culturally biased. And then he says, to Carrie's point, that one of the purposes of MCAS is to reveal the gaps, and if there are any, to make the data available to schools to make it clear which subgroups need additional assistance. They show those results and hope they can be used to find solutions. So is that not a useful tool?
No, it's not. I mean, again, we already know where the gaps are. The gaps are, I mean, all you have to, I mean, these tests, the results of these tests are highly correlated to income, highly correlated to zip code and where you live. So we already know that. These tests are instruments that are being imposed in our schools for the plain, simple fact of profit-making. You know, that's it. I mean, they have no educational value whatsoever. In fact, you know, for an organization that's against poverty, you know, these tests, these high-stakes tests actually exacerbate poverty. If
How?
Anything.
How?
Well, because you have a lot of youth who are not able to graduate as a result of these graduation requirements. You have to pass this do or die test in order to graduate, regardless of how well you do in your classes, you know, in your classwork. And so you have kids, you know, who don't have diplomas, you know, who are not able to get adequate employment, who are not able to form stable families, and so forth and so on. I find that as highly problematic. Any organization that fights against poverty should be an organization that also fights against high-stakes testing.
Carrie, go ahead.
But what does graduation actually mean if you aren't proficient in reading, in math? I mean, where are you going? What job are you taking? I mean, take a look at the remedial education rates we see in our community colleges. It's upwards of 70% for our community because we're handing our children a piece of paper that says you're prepared, you're ready to go, you're ready to launch, enter the workforce, go on to higher education. Then they get to the doors of college and they find out they don't have the skills, that they're not adequately prepared.
Can I just ask you about that for a second? I mean, so these are kids who are going to community college and, as you say, still need remedial work with things like reading, but ostensibly they've passed the MCAS, the 10th grade MCAS. So what good is MCAS doing in
because
that case?
Because it's not good enough, quite clearly. I mean, the MCAS is not the end-all be-all, and I think we should continue to rigorously challenge our kids. I don't think that MCAS is perfect by any means. Okay. We need to make sure. My goal as a parent is not to make sure my child gets the highest score in the MCAS. I want my child to have a successful, wonderful life and be able to go to college and achieve whatever they want to achieve. But unless I have given them the foundation and education they need, the core, the basics. Yeah. Like, what are we actually giving these kids?
Ricardo Rosa, I know you want to get
MCAS is not the foundation. It doesn't provide the foundation. What it does is it's a test that measures a very small amount of a wider knowledge system. And so what happens is that teachers begin to game the system. It's no different. Daniel Koretz has also pointed this out. It's no different than Volkswagen and sort of these emission systems that Volkswagen tries to beat. You know, what's happening in schools right now because of these high-stakes tests is that teachers and administrators are constantly focused on sort of beating this test on test prep instead of real education. I mean, that's the problem that we're up against. And so by beating the system, I'm not talking about sort of erasing scores and placing the correct scores on children's exams. I'm talking about the very fact that test prep is the name of the game. I mean, that for me is highly problematic. It's about just trying to beat the system. It's not about education.
Well, it's almost a coin flip who gets the last word here. So I'm not picking sides, but Carrie Rodriguez, you got about 10 seconds if you want another shot at this.
When it comes to the high stakes testing, I hate the fact that it's high stakes because I want to know who's creating that pressure cooker for our kids. And I think that this should be a measure we use to improve our system. We've got to do it.
But we have that. NAEP, we have that. Well, we've had that.
We'll come back and talk about that test on another day because that's an interesting thought to end on. Ricardo Rosa, Assistant Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy at UMass Dartmouth, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And Carrie Rodriguez, founder of Massachusetts Parents United, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.